Back down on the street, it's raining again. I flag a cab. The gallery is a dozen blocks away, and I feel the tensile strength of my nerves hit the ceiling as we roll down Damon Avenue, a parking lot of cabs in the crest of the evening's wavelength. I abandon my ride and join the hipster-heavy crowd marching through the freezing drizzle. Oomph is an old packing plant turned art gallery, and the line to get inside runs halfway down the block. A miserable, shivering 45 minutes later, I'm finally out of the rain and paying my $15 admission fee and being whisked with a group of 10 people into an anteroom with Daniela's first and last name in gigantic graffiti-style letters on the encircling wall. During our 15 years together, I've attended plenty of exhibits and openings with Daniela, but I've never experienced anything like this. A slim, bearded man emerges from a hidden door in the wall. The lights dim. He says, "I'm Steve Concalli, the producer of what you're about to see." He rips a plastic produce bag off a dispenser by the door. "Phones go in the bag. You get them back on the other side." The bag of accumulating phones makes the rounds. "A word about the next 10 minutes of your life. The artist asks that you set aside your intellectual processing and make an effort to experience her installation emotionally. Welcome to Entanglement." Concalli takes the bag of phones and opens the door. I'm the last one through. For a moment, our group is bunched up in a dark, confined space that turns pitch black as the echo of the slammed door reveals a vast, warehouse-like room. My attention is drawn skyward as points of light fade in above us. Stars. They look startlingly real, each containing a smoldering quality. Some are close, some are distant, and every now and then one streaks through the void. I see what lies ahead. Someone in our group mutters, "Oh my God!" It's a labyrinth built of plexiglass, which by some visual effect appears to stretch on infinitely under the universe of stars. Ripples of light travel through the panels. Our group shuffles forward. There are 5 entrances to the labyrinth, and I stand at the nexus of all of them, watching the others drift ahead on their separate paths. A low-level sound that has been there all along catches my attention. It's not music so much as white noise, like television static, hissing over a deep, sustained tone. I choose a path, and as I enter the labyrinth, the transparency vanishes. The plexiglass is engulfed in near-blinding light, even under my feet. 1 minute in, some of the panels begin to show looped imagery. Birth, child screaming, mother weeping with joy, a condemned man kicking and twisting at the end of a noose, a snowstorm, the ocean, a desert landscape scrolling past. I continue along my path, into dead ends, around blind curves, the imagery appearing with greater frequency on faster loops. The crumpled remains of a car crash. A couple in the throes of passionate sex. The point of view of a patient rolling down a hospital corridor on a gurney with nurses and doctors looking down. The cross, the Buddha, the pentagram, the peace sign, a nuclear detonation. The lights go out. The stars return. I can see through the plexiglass again, only now there's some kind of digital filter overlaid on the transparency, static and swarming insects and falling snow. It makes the others in the labyrinth look like silhouettes moving through a vast wasteland. And despite the confusion and fear of the last 24 hours, or perhaps precisely because of all I've experienced, what I'm witnessing in this moment breaks through and hits me hard. While I can see the others in the labyrinth, it doesn't feel like we're in the same room or even the same space. They seem worlds apart and lost in their own vectors. I'm struck for a fleeting moment by the overwhelming sense of loss. Not grief or pain, but something more primal. A realization and the terror that follows it, terror of the limitless indifference surrounding us. I don't know if that's the intended takeaway from Daniela's installation, but it's certainly mine. We're all just wandering through the tundra of our existence, assigning value to worthlessness. When all that we love and hate, all we believe in and fight for and kill for and die for, is as meaningless as images projected onto plexiglass. At the labyrinth's exit, there's one last loop. A man and a woman each hold the tiny hand of their child as they run together up a grassy hill under a clear blue sky. With the following words slowly materializing on the panel: "Nothing exists. All is a dream. God, man, the world, the sun, the moon, the wilderness of stars. A dream, all a dream. They have no existence. Nothing exists save empty space. And you. And you are not you. You have no body, no blood, no bones. You are but a thought." Mark Twain. I step into another anteroom, where the rest of my group huddles around the plastic bag, retrieving their phones. On through into a large, well-lit gallery with glossy hardwood floors, art-adorned walls, a violin trio, and a woman in a stunning black dress, standing on a riser, addressing the crowd. It takes me a full 5 seconds to realize this is Daniela. She's radiant, holding a glass of red wine in one hand and gesturing with the other. "Just the most amazing night, and I'm so grateful to all of you for coming out to support my new project. It means the world." Daniela raises her wine glass. "Salud!" The crowd responds in turn, and as everyone drinks, I move toward her. In proximity, she's electric, so sparkling with life that I have to restrain myself from calling out to her. This is Daniela with an energy like the first time we met 15 years ago, before years of life, the normalcy, the elation, the depression, the compromise, transformed her into the woman who now shares my bed. Amazing mother, amazing wife, but fighting always against the whispers of what might have been. My Daniela carries a weight and a distance in her eyes that scare me sometimes. This Daniela is an inch off the ground. I'm now standing less than 10 feet away, my heart thumping, wondering if she'll spot me. And then, eye contact. Hers go wide and her mouth opens, and I can't tell if she's horrified or delighted or just surprised to see my face. She pushes through the crowd, throws her arms around my neck, and pulls me in tight with, "Oh my God, I can't believe you came. Is everything all right? I'd heard you left the country for a while or were missing or something." I'm not sure how to respond to that, so I just say, "Well, here I am." Daniela hasn't worn perfume in years, but she's wearing it tonight. And she smells like Daniela without me, like Daniela before our separate scents merged into us. I don't want to let go. I need her touch, but she pulls away. I ask, "Where's Charlie?"
"Who?"
"Charlie."
"Who are you talking about?"
Something torques inside of me.
"Jason?"
She doesn't know who our son is. Do we even have a son? Does Charlie exist?
Of course he exists. I was at his birth. I held him 10 seconds after he came writhing and screaming into the world. "Everything okay?" she asks.
"Yeah, I just came through the labyrinth."
"What did you think?"
It almost made me cry.
"It was all you," she says.
"What do you mean?"
"That conversation we had a year and a half ago, when you came to see me. You inspired me, Jason. I thought of you every day I was building it. I thought of what you said. Didn't you see the dedication?"
"No, where was it?"
"At the entrance of the labyrinth. It's for you. I dedicated it to you, and I've been trying to reach you. I wanted you to be my special guest for tonight, but no one could find you."
She smiles.
"You're here now. That's all that matters."
My heart is going so fast, the room threatening to spin, and then Ryan Holder is standing next to Daniela with his arm around her. He's wearing a tweed jacket, his hair is graying, and he's paler and less fit than the last time I saw him.
which was impossibly at Village Tap last night at his celebration for winning the Pavia Prize. "Well, well," Ryan says, shaking my hand. "Mr. Pavia, the man himself." Daniela says, "Guys, I have to go be polite and mingle, but Jason, I'm having a secret get-together at my apartment after this. You'll come?"
"I'd love to."
As I watch Daniela vanish into the crowd, Ryan says, "Want to get a drink?"
"God, yes."
The gallery has pulled out all the stops, tuxedoed waiters carrying trays of appetizers and champagne, and a cash bar on the far side of the room under a triptych of Daniela's self-portraits. As the barkeep pours our whiskeys, Macallan 12s, into plastic cups, Ryan says, "I know you're doing just fine, but I got these." It's so strange. He carries none of the arrogance and swagger of the man I saw holding court last night at my local bar. We take our scotches and find a quiet corner away from the mob surrounding Daniela. As we stand there watching the room fill with more and more people emerging from the labyrinth, I ask, "So what have you been up to? I feel like I lost track of your trajectory." "I moved over to UChicago."
"Congrats. So you're teaching?"
"Cellular and molecular neuroscience. I've been pursuing some pretty cool research as well, involving the prefrontal cortex."
"Sounds exciting." Ryan leans in close. "All seriousness, the rumor mill has been crazy. The whole community's talking. People saying," he lowers his voice, "that you cracked up and lost your mind, that you're in a rubber room somewhere, that you're dead."
"Here I am. Lucid, warm, and breathing."
"So that compound I built for you, it worked out, I assume?"
I just stare at him, no idea what he's talking about. And when I don't provide an immediate answer, he says,
"Right, I get it. They got you buried under a mountain of NDAs.
I sip my drink. I'm still hungry, and the alcohol is traveling too fast to my head. When the next waiter passes within range, I grab 3 mini quiches off the silver tray. Whatever is bugging him, Ryan can't let it go.
"Look, I don't mean to bitch," he says, "but I just feel like I did a lot of work for you and Velocity in the dark. You and I go way back, and I get that you're in a different place in your career, but I don't know. I think you got what you wanted from me and..."
"What?"
"Forget it."
"No, please.
You could have shown your old college roommate a little more respect, is all I'm saying.
What compound are you talking about?"
He looks at me with thinly veiled contempt.
"Fuck you." We stand silently on the outskirts as the room grows dense with people.
"So, are you two together?" I ask. "You and Daniela?"
"Sort of," he says.
"What does that mean?"
"We've been seeing each other for a little while."
"You always had a thing for her, didn't you?"
He just smirks. Scanning the crowd, I find Daniela. She's poised and in the moment, surrounded by reporters with notepads flipped open, scribbling furiously as she speaks.
"And how's it going?" I ask, though I'm not sure I really want the answer.
"You and my... and Daniela."
"Amazing. She's the woman of my dreams."
He smiles enigmatically, and for 3 seconds, I want to murder him. At 1 a.m, I'm sitting on a sofa at Daniela's place, watching as she sees the last of her guests to the door. These past few hours have been a challenge, trying to hold semi-coherent conversations with Daniela's art friends while biding my time to get an actual moment alone with her. Apparently, that moment will continue to elude me. Ryan Holder, the man who's sleeping with my wife, is still here, and as he collapses into a leather chair across from me, I get the sense that he's settling in, possibly for the night. From a heavy rocks glass, I sip the dregs of a single malt. Not drunk, but good and goddamn buzzed, the alcohol serving as a nice buffer between my psyche and this rabbit hole I've fallen down. This wonderland purporting to be my life. I wonder if Daniela wants me to leave, if I'm that oblivious, last remaining guest who doesn't realize when he's outstayed his welcome. She shuts the door and hooks the chain. Kicking off her heels, she stumbles over to the sofa and crashes down onto the cushions with, "What a night!" She opens the drawer to the end table beside the couch and pulls out a lighter and a stained glass pipe. Daniela quit weed when she became pregnant with Charlie and never took it up again. I watch her take a hit and then offer me the pipe, and because this night can't get any stranger, why not? Soon we're all stoned and sitting in the softly humming silence of the spacious loft whose walls are covered in a vast, eclectic array of art. Daniela has the blind swept back from the huge, south-facing window that serves as the backdrop to the living room, the downtown a twinkling spectacle beyond the glass. Ryan passes the pipe to Daniela, and as she begins to repack the bowl, my old roommate slumps back in the chair and stares at the ceiling. The way he keeps licking the front of his teeth makes me smile, because it was always his weed tick, even from back in our grad school days. I look through that window at all the lights and ask, "How well do you two know me?" That seems to catch their attention. Daniela sets the pipe on the table and turns on the sofa so she's facing me, her knees drawn into her chest. Ryan's eyes snap open. He straightens in the chair. "What do you mean?" Daniela asks. "Do you trust me?" She reaches over and touches my hand. Pure electricity.
"Of course, honey."
Ryan says, "Even when you and I have been on the outs, I've always respected your decency and integrity." Daniela looks concerned.
"Everything okay?"
"I shouldn't do this. I really shouldn't do this. But I'm going to." "A hypothetical," I say. "A man of science, a physics professor, is living here in Chicago. He isn't wildly successful like he always dreamed, but he's happy, mostly content, and married." I look at Daniela, thinking of how Ryan described it back at the gallery. To the woman of his dreams, they have a son, they have a good life. One night, this man goes to a bar to see an old friend, a college buddy who recently won a prestigious award. On the walk back, something happens. He never makes it home. He's abducted. The events are murky, but when he finally regains his full presence of mind, he's in a lab in South Chicago, and everything has changed. His house is different. He's not a professor anymore. He's no longer married to this woman. Daniela asks,
"Are you saying he thinks these things have changed, or that they've actually changed?"
"I'm saying that from his perspective, this isn't his world anymore." "He has a brain tumor," Ryan suggests. I look at my old friend. MRI says no. "Then maybe people are messing with him, running an elaborate prank that infiltrates every aspect of his life. I think I saw that in a movie once." In less than 8 hours, the inside of his house was completely renovated. And not just different pictures on the walls, new appliances, new furniture, light switches were moved. No prank could possibly be this complex. And what would be the point? This is just a normal guy. Why would anyone want to mess with him at this level? "Then he's crazy," Ryan says. "I'm not crazy." It becomes very quiet in the loft. Daniela takes hold of my hand.
"What are you trying to tell us, Jason?"
I look at her. "Earlier tonight, you told me that a conversation you and I had inspired your installation."
"It did."
"Can you tell me about this conversation?"
"You don't remember?"
"Not a single word of it."
"How is that possible?"
"Please, Daniela." There's a long pause while she searches my eyes, maybe to confirm that I'm serious. She finally says,
"It was spring, I think. We hadn't seen each other in a while, and we hadn't really spoken since we went our separate ways all those years ago. I had been following your success, of course. I was always so proud of you. Anyway, you showed up at my studio one night, out of the blue, said you'd been thinking about me lately, and at first I thought you were just trying to hook up with an old flame. But this was something else. You seriously don't remember any of this?"
"It's like I wasn't even there."
"We started talking about your research. how you were involved with this project that was under wraps, and you said, I remember this very clearly, you said you probably wouldn't see me again. And I realized that you hadn't stopped by to catch up. You had come to say goodbye. Then you told me that our existence was all about choices, and that you had blown some of them, but none so badly as with me. You said you were sorry for everything. It was very emotional. You left and I didn't hear from you or see you again until tonight. Now I have a question for you.
Okay. Between the booze and dope and trying to unpack what she's telling me, I'm reeling.
When you saw me tonight at the reception, the first thing you asked me was if I knew where Charlie was. Who's that?
One of the things I love most about Daniela is her honesty. She has a direct link hardwired from her heart to her mouth. No filter, no self-revision. She says what she feels without a shred of guile or cunning. She works no angles. So when I look into Daniela's eyes and see that she's utterly sincere, it nearly breaks me. It doesn't matter, I say.
Obviously it does. We haven't seen each other in a year and a half, and that's the first thing you ask me?
I finish off my drink, crunching the last melting ice cube between my molars. Charlie is our son. The color leaves her face.
Hold on, Ryan says, his words sharp. I thought we were just having a stoner conversation. What is this?
He looks at Daniela, back to me.
Is this a joke?
No, it's not. Daniela says, we don't have a son, and you know it.
We haven't been together in 15 years. You know this, Jason. You know this.
I suppose I could try to convince her right now. I know so much about this woman, secrets from her childhood that she only revealed in the last 5 years of our marriage. But I worry these revelations would backfire, that she wouldn't see them as proofs, but sleights of hand, parlor tricks. I'm betting the best approach to persuade her I'm telling the truth is clear-eyed sincerity. I say, here's what I know, Daniela. You and I live in my brownstone in Logan Square. We have a 14-year-old son named Charlie. I'm a middling professor at Lakemont. You're an amazing wife and mother who sacrificed her art career to stay at home. And you, Ryan, you're a famous neuroscientist. You won the Pavia Prize. You've lectured all over the world. And I know this sounds absolutely crazy, but I don't have a brain tumor. No one is messing with me, and I haven't lost my mind. Ryan laughs, but there's an unmistakable twinge of discomfort in it. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that everything you just said is true, or at least that you believe it. The unknown variable in this story is what you've been working on these last few years, this secret project. What can you tell us about it? Nothing. Ryan struggles onto his feet.
You're going?
Daniela asks. It's late. I've had enough. I say, Ryan, it's not that I won't tell you. I can't tell you. I have no memory of it. I'm a physics professor. I woke up in this lab and everyone thought I belonged there. But I don't. Ryan takes his hat and heads for the door. Halfway across the threshold, he turns and faces me, says, you're not well. Let me take you to the hospital. I've already been. I'm not going back. He looks at Daniela. Do you want him to leave? She turns to me, considering, I'm guessing, whether she wants to be left alone with a madman. What if she decides not to trust me? She finally shakes her head, says,
it's fine.
Ryan, I say, what compound did you make for me? He just glares at me, and for a moment, I think he's going to answer, the tension draining out of his face, as if he's trying to decide whether I'm crazy or just being a stoned asshole. And all at once, he arrives at his conclusion. Hardness returns. He says with zero warmth in his voice, good night, Daniela. Then turns, goes, slams the door behind him.
Daniela walks into the guest room wearing yoga pants and a tank top and carrying a cup of tea. I've had a shower. I don't feel any better, but at least I'm clean. The hospital stench of sickness and Clorox gone. Sitting on the edge of the mattress, she hands me the mug.
Chamomile.
I cup my hands around the hot ceramic, say, you didn't have to do this. I have a place I can go.
You're staying here with me. End of story.
She crawls across my legs and sits beside me, her back against the headboard. I sip the tea. It's warm, soothing, faintly sweet. Daniela looks over.
When you went to the hospital, what did they think was wrong with you?
They didn't know. They wanted to commit me.
To a psych ward?
Yeah.
And you wouldn't consent?
No, I left.
So it would have been an involuntary thing.
That's right.
Are you sure that's not what's best at this point, Jason? I mean, what would you think if someone were saying to you the things you're saying to me?
I'd think he was out of his mind, but I'd be wrong.
Then tell me, she says. What do you think is happening to you?
I'm not entirely sure.
But you're a scientist. You have a theory.
I don't have enough data.
What does your gut tell you?
I sip the chamomile tea, savoring the hit of warmth as it slides down my throat. We all live day to day completely oblivious to the fact that we're a part of a much larger and stranger reality than we can possibly imagine. She takes my hand in hers, and even though she isn't Daniela as I know her, I cannot hide from how madly I love this woman, even here and now, sitting in this bed, in this wrong world. I look over at her, those Spanish eyes glassy and intense. It takes all my willpower to keep my hands off her.
Are you afraid? She asks.
I think back to the man who took me at gunpoint, to that lab, to the team that followed me back to my brownstone and tried to apprehend me. I think of the man smoking a cigarette under my hotel room window. On top of all the elements of my identity and this reality that don't align, there are very real people out there, beyond these walls, who want to find me, who have hurt me before and possibly want to hurt me again. A sobering thought crashes over me. Could they track me here? Have I put Daniela in danger? No. If she isn't my wife, if she's only a girlfriend from 15 years ago, why would she be on anyone's radar?
Jason, and she asks again, are you afraid?
Very. She reaches up, gently touches my face, says,
bruises.
I don't know how I got them.
Tell me about him.
Who?
Charlie.
This must be so weird for you.
I can't pretend it's not.
Well, I told you, he's 14, almost 15. His birthday is October 21st, and he was born premature at Chicago Mercy. A whopping 1 pound, 15 ounces. He needed a lot of help his first year, but he was a fighter. Now he's healthy and as tall as I am. Tears well up in her eyes. He has dark hair like you and a wonderful sense of humor. Solid B student. Very right-brained, like his mama. He's into Japanese comics and skateboards. Loves to draw these crazy landscapes. I don't think it's too early to say that he has your eye for it.
Stop it.
What? She closes her eyes, and the tears squeeze out of the corners and spill down her cheeks.
We don't have a son.
You swear to me you have no memory of him? I ask.
This isn't some game.
If you tell me now, I won't—
Jason, we broke up 15 years ago.
Well, to be specific, you ended it with me. That is not true.
I had told you the day before that I was pregnant. You needed time to think about it. You came to my loft and said it was the hardest decision you'd ever made, but you were busy with your research, the research that would ultimately win that big award. You said the next year of your life would be in a clean room and that I deserved better,
that our child deserved better.
I say, that is not how it happened. I told you that it wasn't going to be easy, but that we'd make it work. We got married. You had Charlie. I lost my funding. You quit painting. I became a professor. You became a full-time mother.
And yet here we are tonight, not married, no children. You just came from the opening of the installation that's going to make me famous, and you did win that prize. I don't know what's going on in your head. Maybe you do have competing memories, but I know what's real.
I stare down at the steam rising off the surface of the tea. Do you think I'm crazy? I ask.
I have no idea. But you're not well.
And she looks at me with the compassion that has always defined her. I touch the ring of thread that's tied around my finger like a talisman. I say, look, maybe you believe what I'm telling you, maybe you don't, but I need you to know that I believe it. I would never lie to you. This is possibly the most surreal moment I've experienced since coming to consciousness in that lab, sitting in bed in the guest room of the apartment of the woman who is my wife but isn't, talking about the son we apparently never had, about the life that wasn't ours. I wake alone in bed in the middle of the night, my heart pounding, the darkness spinning, the inside of my mouth sickeningly dry. For a full terrifying minute, I have no idea where I am. This isn't the alcohol or the pot. It's a much deeper level of disorientation. I wrap the covers tightly around me, but I can't stop shaking, and a full body ache is growing more painful by the second. My legs restless, my head throbbing. The next time my eyes open, the room is filled with daylight, and Daniela is standing over me, looking worried.
You're burning up, Jason. I should take you to the ER.
I'll be fine.
You don't look fine.
She places a freezing washcloth across my forehead.
How does that feel?
She asks. Good, but you don't have to do this. I'll grab a cab back to my hotel.
Just try to leave.
In the early afternoon, my fever breaks. Daniela cooks me chicken noodle soup from scratch, and I eat sitting up in bed while she sits in a chair in the corner with a distance in her eyes I know too well. She's lost in thought, mulling something over, and doesn't notice that I'm watching her. I don't mean to stare, but I can't take my eyes off her. She is still so utterly Daniela, except her hair is shorter, she's in better shape. She's wearing makeup, and her clothes, jeans and a form-fitting tee, age her down considerably from 39 years.
Am I happy?
She asks. What do you mean?
In our life that you say we share together. Am I happy?
I thought you didn't want to talk about it.
I couldn't sleep last night. It was all I could think about.
I think you're happy.
Even without my art?
You miss it, for sure. You see old friends finding success, and I know you're happy for them. But I also know it stings, just like it does for me. It's a bonding agent between us.
You mean we're both losers?
We are not losers.
Are we happy?
Together, I mean. I set the bowl of soup aside. Yeah, there have been rough patches, like with any marriage, but we have a son, a home, a family. You're my best friend. She looks straight at me and asks with a devious smirk,
how's our sex life?
I just laugh. She says,
oh God, did I actually make you blush?
You did.
But you didn't answer my question.
I didn't, did I?
What's wrong? Is it not good?
She's flirting now. No, it's great. You're just embarrassing me. She gets up and walks over to the bed. Sits on the edge of the mattress and stares at me with those huge, deep eyes. What are you thinking? I ask. She shakes her head.
That if you aren't crazy or full of shit, then we just had the strangest conversation in human history. I sit in bed watching the daylight fade over Chicago. Whatever storm system brought the rain last night has blown out, and in its wake, the sky is clear and the trees have turned, and there's a stunning quality to the light as it moves toward evening, polarized and golden, that I can only describe as loss. Robert Frost's gold that cannot stay. Out in the kitchen, pots are banging, cabinets are opening and closing, and the scent of cooking meats drifts back down the hallway, into the guest room with a smell that strikes me as suspiciously familiar. I climb out of bed, stable on my feet for the first time all day, and head for the kitchen. Bach is playing, red wine is open, and Daniela stands at the island, chopping an onion on the soapstone countertop in an apron and a pair of swimming goggles. "Smells amazing," I say.
"Would you mind stirring it?"
I walk over to the range and lift the lid off a deep pot. The steam rising into my face takes me home.
"How are you feeling?" she asks.
"Like a different man."
"So, better?"
"Much." It's a traditional Spanish dish. A bean stew made with an assortment of native legumes and meats. Chorizo, pancetta, black sausage. Daniela cooks it once or twice a year, usually on my birthday, or when the snow flies on a weekend and we just feel like drinking wine and cooking together all day. I stir the stew, replace the lid. Daniela says,
"It's a bean stew from..."
It slips out before I think to stop myself. "Your mother's recipe. Well, to be specific, her mother's mother." Daniela stops cutting. She looks back at me. "Put me to work," I say.
"What else do you know about me?"
"Look, from my perspective, we've been together 15 years, so I know almost everything."
"And from mine, it was only 2.5 months, and that was a lifetime ago. And yet you know this recipe was handed down through my family over several generations."
For a moment, it becomes uncannily quiet in the kitchen. Like the air between us carries a positive charge, humming on some frequency right at the edge of our perception. She says finally,
"If you want to help, I'm preparing toppings for the stew, and I could tell you what those are, but you probably already know."
"Grated cheddar, cilantro, and sour cream?" She gives the faintest smile and raises an eyebrow.
"Like I said, you already know."
We have dinner at the table beside the huge window with the candlelight reflecting in the glass and the city lights burning beyond, our local constellation. The food is spectacular. Daniela is beautiful in the firelight, and I'm feeling grounded for the first time since I stumbled out of that lab. At the end of dinner, our bowls empty, second wine bottle killed, she reaches across the glass table and touches my hand.
"I don't know what's happening to you, Jason, but I'm glad you found your way to me."
I want to kiss her. She took me in when I was lost, when the world stopped making sense. But I don't kiss her. I just squeeze her hand and say, "You have no idea what you've done for me." We clear the table, load the dishwasher, and tackle the remaining sink full of dishes. I wash, she dries, and puts away, like an old married couple. Apropos of nothing, I say, "Ryan Holder, huh?" She stops wiping down the interior of the stockpot and looks at me.
"Do you have an opinion about that you'd like to share?"
"No, it's just..."
"What? He was your roommate, your friend. You don't approve?"
"He always had a thing for you."
"Are we jealous?"
"Of course."
"Oh, grow up. He's a beautiful man."
She goes back to her drawing. "So how serious is it?" I ask.
"We've been out a few times.
Nobody's leaving their toothbrushes at anyone's house yet." "Well, I think he'd like to. He seems pretty smitten." Daniela smirks.
"How could he not be? I'm amazing."
I lie in bed in the guest room with the window cracked so the city noise can put me under like a sound machine. Staring out the tall window, I watch the sleeping city. Last night, I set out to answer a simple question. Where is Daniela? And I found her, a successful artist living alone. We've never been married, never had a son. Unless I'm the victim of the most elaborate prank of all time, the nature of Daniela's existence appears to support the revelation these last 48 hours have been building toward. This is not my world. Even as those five words cross my mind, I'm not exactly certain what they mean, or how to begin to consider their full weight. So I say it again. I try it on, see how it fits. This is not my world. A soft knock at my door startles me out of a dream. Come in. Daniela enters, climbs into bed beside me. I sit up, ask, everything okay?
I can't sleep.
What's wrong? She kisses me. And it isn't like kissing my wife of 15 years. It's like kissing my wife 15 years ago for the first time. Pure energy and collision. As I'm on top of her, my hands running up the inside of her thighs, driving the satin chemise over her bare hips, I stop. She says, breathless,
why are you stopping?
And I almost say, I can't do this, you're not my wife. But that isn't even true. This is Daniela, the only human being in this insane world who has helped me. And yes, maybe I am trying to justify it. But I'm so turned around, upside down, terrified, desperate, that I don't just want it. I need this. And I think she does too. I stare down into her eyes, smoky and glistening in the light stealing through the window. Eyes you can fall into and keep falling. She isn't the mother of my son. She isn't my wife. We haven't made a life together. But I love her all the same. And not just the version of Daniela that exists in my head, in my history. I love the physical woman underneath me in this bed, here and now, wherever this is, because it's the same arrangement of matter, same eyes, same voice, same smell, same taste. It isn't married people lovemaking that follows. We have fumbling, groping, backseat of the car, unprotected because who gives a fuck protons smashing together sex. Moments after, sweaty and shaky, we lie intertwined and gazing out at the lights of our city. Daniela's heart is banging away in her chest, and I can feel the bump, bump of it against my side, decelerating now. Slower. Slower.
Everything okay? She whispers. I can hear the wheels turning up there.
I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't found you.
Well, you did. And whatever's happening, I'm here for you. You know that, right?
She runs her fingers across my hands. They stop at the piece of thread tied around my ring finger.
What's this? She asks.
Proof, I say.
Proof?
That I'm not crazy. It becomes quiet again. I'm not sure of the time, but it's definitely past 2 in the morning. The bars will be closed now. The streets as quiet and subdued as they get, with the exception of snowstorm nights. The air creeping through the crack in the window is the coldest of the season. It trickles across our sweat-glazed bodies. I need to get back to my house, I say.
Your place in Logan Square?
Yeah.
What for?
I apparently have a home office. I want to get on the computer, see exactly what I've been working on. Maybe I'll find papers, notes, something that will shed some light on what's happening to me.
I can drive you over first thing in the morning.
You probably shouldn't.
Why?
Might not be safe.
Why wouldn't it?
Out in the living room, a loud bang rattles the door, like someone pounding on it with their fist. the way I imagine cops knock. I ask, who the hell is that at this hour? Daniela climbs out of bed and walks naked out of the room. It takes me a minute to find my boxer shorts and the twisted-up comforter, and by the time I pull them on, Daniela is emerging from her bedroom in a terry cloth robe. We head out into the living room. The pounding on the door continues as Daniela approaches.
Don't open it, I whisper.
Obviously. As she leans into the peephole, the phone rings. We both startle. Daniela crosses the living room toward the cordless lying on the coffee table. I glance through the peephole, see a man standing in the hallway, his back to the door. He's on a cell phone. Daniela answers,
hello?
The man is dressed in black, Doc Martens, jeans, a leather jacket. Daniela says into the phone, who is this? I move toward her and point to the door, mouthing,
it's him?
She nods.
What does he want?
She points at me. Now I can hear the man's voice coming simultaneously through the door and through the speaker on her cordless. She says into the phone,
I don't know what you're talking about. It's just me here, and I live alone, and I'm not letting a strange man into my home at 2 in the...
The door explodes open. The chain snaps and flies across the room, and the man steps in, raising a pistol with a long black tube screwed into the barrel. He aims it at both of us, and as he kicks the door closed, I smell old and recent cigarette smoke wafting into the loft. You're here for me, I say. She has nothing to do with any of this. He's an inch or two shorter than I am, but sturdier. His head is shaved, and his eyes are gray, and not so much cold as remote, as if they don't see me as a human being, but rather as information. Ones and zeros, the way a machine might. My mouth has gone dry. There's a strange distance between what's happening and my processing of it. A disconnect, a delay. I should do something, say something, but I feel paralyzed by the suddenness of the man's presence. I'll go with you, I say, just... His aim shifts slightly away from me and up. Daniela says,
wait, no!
She's cut off by a burst of fire and a muted report not quite as loud as a naked gunshot. A fine red mist blinds me for half a second, and Daniela sits on the sofa, a hole dead center between her big, dark eyes. I start toward her, screaming, but every molecule in my body seizes, muscles clenching uncontrollably with stunning agony, and I crash down through the coffee table, shaking and grunting in broken glass and telling myself this isn't happening. The smoking man lifts my useless arms behind my back and binds my wrists together, cruciform with a zip tie. Then I hear a tearing sound. He pats a piece of duct tape over my mouth and sits behind me in the leather chair. I'm screaming through the tape, pleading for this not to be happening, but it is, and there's nothing I can do to change it. I hear the man's voice behind me, calm and occupying a higher register than I would have imagined.
Hey, I'm here.
No, why don't you come around back?
Exactly. Where the recycling and dumpsters are. The back gate and rear door to the building are both open. Two should be fine. We're in pretty good shape up here, but you know, let's not linger.
Yep.
Okay, sounds good.
The excruciating effect of what I assume was a taser is finally relenting, but I'm too weak to move. From my vantage point, all I can see are the lower half of Daniela's legs. I watch a line of blood run down her right ankle, across the top of her foot, between her toes, and begin to puddle on the floor. I hear the man's phone buzz. He answers,
hey, baby. I know, I just didn't want to wake you. Yeah, something came up. I don't know, might be morning. How about I take you to breakfast at the Golden Apple whenever I wrap up? He laughs. Okay, love you too. Sweet dreams.
My eyes sheet over with tears. I shout through the tape, shout until my throat burns, thinking maybe he'll shoot me or knock me unconscious, anything to stop the exquisite pain of this moment. but it doesn't seem to bother him at all. He just sits there quietly, letting me rage and scream. 6. Daniela sits in the bleachers under the scoreboard, above the ivy-covered outfield wall. It's Saturday afternoon, the last home game of the regular season, and she's with Jason and Charlie, watching the Cubs get their asses kicked in their sold-out ballpark. The warm autumn day is cloudless, windless, timeless. The air redolent of roasted peanuts, popcorn, plastic cups filled to the brim with beer. Daniela finds the roar of the crowd strangely comforting, and they're far enough back from home plate to notice a delay between swing and bat crack. Speed of light versus speed of sound, when a player sends a pitch sailing beyond the wall. They used to come to games when Charlie was a boy, but it's been eons since their last visit to Wrigley Field. When Jason suggested the idea yesterday, she didn't think Charlie would be up for it, but it must be scratching some nostalgic itch in their son's psyche, because he actually wanted to come, and now he seems relaxed and happy. They're all happy. A trio of near-perfect contentment in the sun, eating Chicago-style hot dogs, watching the players run around on the bright grass. As Daniela sits wedged between the two most important men in her life, buzzed off her lukewarm beer, it occurs to her that the field of this afternoon is somehow different. Unsure if it's Charlie or Jason or her. Charlie is in the moment, not checking his phone every 5 seconds, and Jason looks as happy as she's seen him in years. Weightless is the word that comes to mind. His smile seems wider, brighter, more freely given, and he can't keep his hands off her. Then again, maybe the difference is her. Maybe it's this beer and the crystalline quality of the autumn light and the communal energy of the crowd. Which is all to say, maybe it's just being alive at a baseball game on a fall day in the heart of her city. Charlie has plans after the game, so they drop him at a friend's house in Logan Square, stop at the Brownstone to change clothes, and then head out into the evening, just the two of them. Downtown bound, no itinerary, no specific destination. A Saturday night ramble. Cruising in heavy evening traffic down Lakeshore Drive, Daniela looks across the center console of the decade-old Suburban, says, "I think I know what I want to do first." 30 minutes later, they're in a gondola car on a Ferris wheel strung with lights. Rising slowly above the spectacle of Navy Pier, Daniela watches the elegant skyline of their city as Jason holds her tight. At the apex of their single revolution, 150 feet above the carnival, Daniela feels Jason touch her chin and turn her face toward his. They have the car all to themselves. Even up here, the night air is sweetened with the scent of funnel cakes and cotton candy. The laughter of children riding on the carousel. A woman screaming with joy at a hole-in-one on the miniature golf course far below. Jason's intensity shreds through all of it. When he kisses her, she can feel his heart through his windbreaker, jackhammering in his chest. They have dinner in the city at a nicer restaurant than they can afford and spend the entire time talking like they haven't talked in years. Not about people or remember whens, but ideas. They kill a bottle of Tempranillo, order another, thinking maybe they'll spend the night in the city. It's been a long time since Daniela has seen her husband this passionate, this sure of himself. He's a man on fire, in love with his life again. Halfway through their second bottle of wine, he catches her looking out the window, asks, "What are you thinking about?" "That's a dangerous question."
"I'm aware."
"I'm thinking about you."
"What about me?"
"It feels like you're trying to sleep with me."
She laughs.
"What I mean is, it feels like you're trying when you don't have to be trying. We're an old married couple, and I feel like you're,
romancing you?"
"Exactly. Don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. At all. It's amazing. I guess I just don't see where it's all coming from. Are you okay? Is something wrong and you're not telling me?
I'm fine.
So this is all because you almost got hit by a cab 2 nights ago?
He says, I don't know if it was my life flashing before my eyes or what, but when I came home, everything felt different, more real. You especially. Even right now, it's like I'm seeing you for the first time, and I have this nervous ache in my stomach. I think about you every second. I think about all the choices we've made that created this moment. Us sitting here together at this beautiful table. Then I think of all the possible events that could have stopped this moment from ever happening, and it all feels, I don't know.
What?
So fragile. Now he becomes thoughtful for a moment. He says finally, it's terrifying when you consider that every thought we have, every choice we could possibly make, branches into a new world. After the baseball game today, we went to Navy Pier and then came here for dinner, right? But that's only one version of what happened. In a different reality, instead of the pier, we went to the symphony. In one, we stayed home. In another still, we got into a fatal wreck on Lakeshore Drive and never made it anywhere.
But those other realities don't really exist.
Actually, they're just as real as the one you and I are experiencing at this moment.
How is that possible?
It's a mystery, but there are clues. Most astrophysicists believe that the force holding stars and galaxies together, the thing that makes our whole universe work, comes from a theoretical substance we can't measure or observe directly, something they call dark matter. And this dark matter makes up most of the known universe.
But what is it exactly?
No one's really sure. Physicists have been trying to construct new theories to explain its origin and what it is. We know it has gravity, like ordinary matter, but it must be made of something completely new.
A new form of matter.
Exactly. Some string theorists think it might be a clue to the existence of the multiverse.
She looks thoughtful for a moment, then asks, so all these other realities, where are they?
Imagine you're a fish swimming in a pond. You can move forward and back, side to side, but never up out of the water. If someone were standing beside the pond watching you, you'd have no idea they were there. To you, that little pond is an entire universe. Now imagine that someone reaches down and lifts you out of the pond. You see that what you thought was the entire world is only a small pool. You see other ponds, trees, the sky above. You realize you're a part of a much larger and more mysterious reality than you had ever dreamed of.
Daniela leans back in her chair and takes a sip of wine. So all these other thousands of ponds are all around us, right at this moment. But we just can't see them?
Exactly. Jason used to talk like this all the time. Would keep her up late into the night positing wild theories, sometimes trying things out, most of the time just trying to impress her. It worked then. It's working now. She looks away for a moment, staring through the window beside their table, watching the water glide past as the light from the surrounding buildings swirls in a kind of perpetual shimmer across the brown glass surface of the river. She finally looks back at him over the rim of her wine glass, their eyes connecting, the candlelight quivering between them. She says,
in one of those ponds out there, do you think there's another version of you that's stuck with the research? Who made good on all the plans you had in your 20s, before life got in the way?
He smiles. It's crossed my mind.
And there's maybe a version of me that's a famous artist? That traded all this for that?
Jason leans forward, pushing their plates out of the way so he can hold both of her hands across the table. If there are a million ponds out there, with versions of you and me living similar and different lives, there's none better than right here, right now. I'm more sure of that than anything in the world. 7. The bare light bulb in the ceiling rains down a naked and flickering illumination on the tiny cell. I'm strapped to a steel-frame bed, ankles and wrists chained together with restraints and connected via locking carabiners to eye bolts in the concrete wall. Three locks retract in the door, but I'm too sedated to even startle. It swings open. Layton wears a tux, wire-rim glasses. As he approaches, I catch a whiff of cologne, and then alcohol on his breath. Champagne? I wonder where he's just come from. A party? A benefit? There's a pink ribbon still pinned to the satin breast of his jacket. Layton eases down onto the edge of the paper-thin mattress. He looks grave and unbelievably sad.
I'm sure you have some things you want to say, Jason, but I hope you'll let me go first.
I take a lot of blame for what happened. You came back, and we weren't prepared for you to be as unwell as you were, as you are. We failed you, and I'm sorry. I don't know what else to say. I hate everything that's happened. Your return should have been a celebration. Even through the heavy sedation, I'm shaking with grief, with rage. The man who came to Daniela's apartment, did you send him after me? I ask. You left me no choice. Even the possibility you had told her about this place. Did you tell him to kill her? Jason, did you? He doesn't answer, but it is an answer. I stare into Layton's eyes, and all I can think about is ripping his face off down to his skull. You fucking... I break down, sobbing. I cannot exile my brain from the image of blood running down Daniela's bare foot. I'm so sorry, brother. Layton reaches out, puts his hand on my arm, and I nearly dislocate my shoulder trying to pull away. Don't touch me! You've been in this cell almost 24 hours. It gives me no pleasure to keep you restrained and sedated. But as long as you're a danger to yourself or others, this situation can't change. You need to eat and drink something. Are you willing to do that? I focus on a crack in the wall. I imagine using Layton's head to open another one, driving it into the concrete again and again and again until there's nothing left but red paste. Jason, it's either you let them feed you, or I run a G-tube into your stomach. I want to tell him that I'm going to kill him. Him and everyone in this lab. I can feel the words coming up my throat, but better judgment prevails. I'm completely at this man's mercy. I know what you saw in that apartment was horrible, and I'm sorry for that. I wish it had never happened, but sometimes a situation is so far gone. Look, please know that I am so, so sorry you had to see that. Layton rises, moves toward the door, pulls it open. Standing in the threshold, he looks back at me, his face half in light, half in shadow. He says, "Maybe you can't hear this right now, but this place wouldn't exist without you. None of us would be here but for your work, your brilliance. I'm not going to let anyone forget that. Most of all, you." I calm down. I pretend to calm down. Because staying chained up in this tiny cell isn't accomplishing a goddamn thing. From the bed, I stare up into the surveillance camera mounted over the door and ask for Layton. 5 minutes later, he's unlocking my restraints and saying, "I think I'm probably as happy as you are to get you out of these things." He gives me a hand up. My wrists have been rubbed raw from the leather bindings. My mouth is dry. I'm delirious with thirst. He asks, "You feeling any better?" It occurs to me that my first inclination when I woke up in this place was the right one. Be the man they think I am. The only way to pull that off is to pretend my memories and my identity have abandoned me. Let them fill in the blanks.
because if I'm not the man they think I am, then they have no use for me. Then I never leave this lab alive. I tell him, I was scared, that's why I ran.
I totally get it.
I'm sorry I put you through all this, but you have to understand. I'm lost here. There's just this gaping hole where the last 10 years should be. And we're going to do everything in our power to help you recover those memories, to get you better. We're firing up the MRI. We're going to screen you for PTSD. Our psychiatrist, Amanda Lucas, will be speaking with you shortly. You have my word. No stone will be left unturned until we fix this, until we have you fully back. Thank you. You'd do the same for me. Look, I have no idea what you've been through these last 14 months, but the man I've known for 11 years, my colleague and friend who built this place with me, he's locked away somewhere in that head of yours, and there is nothing I won't do to find him. A terrifying thought. What if he's right? I think I know who I am. But there's a part of me that wonders. What if the recollection I have of my real life, husband, father, professor, isn't real? What if it's a byproduct of brain damage I received while working in this lab? What if I'm actually the man who everyone in this world believes I am? No. I know who I am. Layton has been sitting on the edge of the mattress. Now he props his feet up and leans back against the footboard. I have to ask, he says, what were you doing at that woman's apartment? Lie. I'm not entirely sure. How did you know her? I fight to hide the tears and rage. I dated her a long time ago. Let's go back to the beginning. After you escaped through the bathroom window 3 nights ago, how did you get to your home in Logan Square? A cab. Did you tell the driver anything about where you'd just come from? Of course not. Okay, and after you managed to elude us at your house, then where'd you go? Lie. I wandered around all night. I was disoriented, afraid. The next day, I saw this poster for Daniela's art show. That's how I found her. Did you talk to anyone else besides Daniela? Ryan. No.
You're sure about that?
Yes. I went back to her apartment, and it was just the two of us until... You have to understand. We've dedicated everything to this place, to your work. We're all in. Any one of us would lay down our lives to protect it, including you. The gunshot, the black hole between her eyes. It breaks my heart to see you like this, Jason. He says this with genuine bitterness and regret. I can see it in his eyes. We were friends? I ask. He nods, his jaw tight, as if he's holding back a wave of emotion. I say, I'm just having a hard time understanding how murdering someone to protect this lab would be acceptable to you or any of these people. The Jason Dessen I knew wouldn't have given a second thought to what happened to Daniela Vargas. I'm not saying he would have been happy about it. None of us are. It makes me sick. But he would have been willing. I shake my head. He says, you've forgotten what we built together. So show me. They clean me up, give me new clothes, and feed me. After lunch, Layton and I ride a service elevator down to sublevel 4. Last time I walked this corridor, it was lined with plastic, and I had no idea where I was. I haven't been threatened, haven't been told specifically that I can't leave, but I've already noticed that Layton and I are rarely alone. Two men who carry themselves like cops are always on the periphery. I remember these guards from my first night here. It's basically 4 levels, Layton says. Gym, rec room, mess hall, and a few dormitories on 1. Labs, clean rooms, conference rooms on 2. Sublevel 3 is dedicated to fabrication.
4 is the infirmary and mission control. We're moving toward a pair of vault-like doors that look formidable enough to secure national secrets. Layton stops at a touchscreen mounted to the wall beside them. He pulls a key card from his pocket and holds it under the scanner. A computerized female voice says,
"Name, please."
He leans in close. Layton Vance.
Passcode.
1187. Voice recognition confirmed. Welcome, Dr. Vance. The sound of a buzzer startles me, its echo fading down the corridor behind us. The doors open slowly. I step into a hangar. From the rafters high above, lights blaze down, illuminating a 12-foot cube the color of gunmetal. My pulse rate kicks up. I can't believe what I'm looking at. Layton must sense my awe because he says, "Beautiful, isn't it?" It is exquisitely beautiful. At first, I think the hum inside the hangar is coming from the lights, but it can't be. It's so deep I can feel it at the base of my spine, like the ultra-low frequency vibration of a massive engine. I drift toward the box, mesmerized. I never fathomed I would see it in the flesh at this scale. Up close, it isn't smooth, but an irregular surface that reflects the light in such a way as to make it seem multifaceted, almost translucent. Layton gestures to the pristine concrete floor gleaming under the lights. "We found you unconscious, right over there." We walk slowly alongside the box. I reach out, let my fingers graze the surface. It's cold to the touch. Layton says, 11 years ago, after you won the Pavia, we came to you and said we had $5 billion. We could have built a spaceship, but we gave it all to you, to see what you could accomplish with unlimited resources." I ask, "Is my work here, my notes?" "Of course." We reach the far side of the box. He leads me around the next corner. On this side, a door has been cut into the cube. "What's inside?" I ask. "See for yourself." The base of the door frame sits about a foot off the surface of the hangar. I lower the handle, push it open, start to step inside. Layton puts a hand on my shoulder. "No further," he says. "For your own safety." "It's dangerous?" "You were the third person to go inside. Two more went in after you. So far, you're the only one to return." "What happened to them?" "We don't know. Recording devices can't be used inside. The only report we can hope for at this point has to come from someone who manages to make it back. Like you did." The inside of the box is empty, unadorned, and dark. Walls, floor, and ceiling made of the same material as the exterior. Layton says, "It's soundproof, radiation-proof, airtight, and, as you might have guessed, puts out a strong magnetic field." As I close the door, a deadbolt thunks into place on the other side. Staring at the box is like seeing a failed dream raised from the dead. My work in my late 20s involved a box much like this one. Only it was a 1-inch cube designed to put a macroscopic object into superposition. Into what we physicists sometimes call, in what passes for humor among scientists, cat state. As in Schrödinger's cat, the famous thought experiment. Imagine a cat, a vial of poison, and a radioactive source in a sealed box. If an internal sensor registers radioactivity, like an atom decaying, the vial is broken, releasing a poison that kills the cat. The atom has an equal chance of decaying or not decaying. It's an ingenious way of linking an outcome in the classical world, our world, to a quantum-level event. The Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics suggests a crazy thing. Before the box is opened, before observation occurs, the atom exists in superposition, an undetermined state of both decaying and not decaying, which means, in turn, that the cat is both alive and dead. And only when the box is opened and an observation made does the wave function collapse into one of two states. In other words, we only see one of the possible outcomes. For instance, a dead cat. And that becomes our reality. But then things get really weird. Is there another world, just as real as the one we know, where we opened the box and found a purring living cat instead? The many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics says yes. That when we open the box, there's a branch. One universe where we discover a dead cat, one where we discover a live one. And it's the act of our observing the cat that kills it, or lets it live. And then it gets mind-fuckingly weird. Because those kinds of observations happen all the time. So if the world really splits whenever something is observed, that means there's an unimaginably massive, infinite number of universes, a multiverse, where everything that can happen will happen. My concept for my tiny cube was to create an environment protected from observation and external stimuli, so my macroscopic object, an aluminum nitride disc measuring 40 micrometers in length and consisting of around a trillion atoms, could be free to exist in that undetermined cat state and not decohere due to interactions with its environment. I never cracked that problem before my funding evaporated, but apparently some other version of me did, and then scaled the entire concept up to an inconceivable level. Because if what Leighton is saying is true, this box does something that, according to everything I know about physics, is impossible. I feel shamed, like I lost a race to a better opponent. A man of epic vision built this box. A smarter, better me. I look at Leighton. Does it work? He says, "The fact that you're standing here beside me would appear to suggest that it does." I don't get it. If you wanted to put a particle in a quantum state in a lab, you'd create a deprivation chamber, remove all light, suck out the air, turn down the temperature to a fraction of a degree above absolute zero. It would kill a human being. And the larger you go, the more fragile it all becomes. Even though we're underground, there are all sorts of particles, neutrinos, cosmic rays, passing through that cube that could disturb a quantum state. The challenge seems insurmountable.